Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So Justice Breyer to retire, but not before. President Biden selects the black woman of his choosing to backfill Breyer's seat on the Supreme Court.
Got to check those boxes, Dan.
And that may happen before the term ends, before the current term ends. More likely it'll happen before the November election. So perhaps Labor Day-ish before the sprint to November. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. What of that having many people reminded that Biden made this promise when he was running for president? Because, of course, he's always in full pander mode, but that was what he really needed to offer up to distinguish himself in that primary contest between a bunch of identitarian Marxists to show that he wasn't some relic of a bygone era. He's just as current with the new Marxists as anybody. And so that's the commitment he made. And it runs afoul, ironically, of Supreme Court jurisprudence such things like quotas.
He said it twice.
But that's his promise.
He said it twice. He said it one, during two different debates, and this one was with Bernie Sanders.
Committed that if I'm elected president, have an opportunity to appoint someone to the courts, I'll appoint the first black woman to the courts. It's required that they have representation now. It's long overdue.
Because you only have representation on the court if it's somebody who has the same racial background as you. That's how you get representation. You don't get representation on the court by somebody's legal mind, their understanding of the Constitution and fealty to it. I would argue, of course, its originalist interpretation. But that's not how you get representation in elective office or on the high court. You have to have somebody who looks like you, because a white person couldn't be represented by a black person. And a black person couldn't be represented by a white person. And what century are we in?
I know. It's so embarrassing. And then somebody started this crazy rumor that Kamala Harris was going to nominate herself, or that Biden was going to nominate Kamala Harris to the Supreme Court. Did you see that yesterday? That was running
Jeffrey Toobin was talking about it a week ago. Yeah, and talk about, maybe he was rubbing one out at the time and he wasn't thinking clearly. I don't know, but
it took off like wildfire yesterday.
That's ridiculous. That's fodder for people who don't know anything.
Exactly. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. It seemed that Breyer, who's 83, he wanted to make this decision on his own, but somebody from the mainstream media got it out there because, do you think maybe possibly, since the midterms are coming up and they might lose control of the Senate, that they wanted to force him to retire? Hey, buddy, you've been thinking about it, but we want you to do it now. Now is the time.
There's been a movement to push Breyer out, to calling for his retirement from the new Marxists for a while because, he's not one of them. He's just not leftist enough. And so, you had, Schumer's comm people circulating Breyer retire hashtag campaigns last year. This is nothing new. There's been a press on to get rid of him from the left for a while. So now he's going to walk, but he's going to walk in such a way that he doesn't leave the court one justice short. These names, when you have these vacancies, the names most people don't know, you're not following which judges are on which courts, and you get down to a short list of names nobody knows, and the D.C. press corps will never read any opinions of those who've actually have opinions authored in their background, like Ketanji Brown Jackson, who's, you know, one of the shortlisters at this point. But I mean, again, here, since it's just a black woman and that's the only qualification, as I understand it,
right,
based on what the president said, you just heard him say it in that debate, then I don't know, let's do something fun, you know, more 21st century oriented, where merit doesn't matter. Meritocracy is a relic of white supremacy. So let's do something that's more fitting of the left, sort of like celebrity. So I'm thinking of the black Judge Judy. That would be Tanya Acker from Hot Bench, which is one of those shows that's on in the afternoon that Common Clay seem to enjoy based on, I don't know, the salaries that are paid to these people.
Hot Bench. I've never even heard of it. I'm going to have to
Hot Bench, Tanya
right
Acker.
Now.
Look her up.
Looking her up right now. Yeah.
Yeah. They do like these three judge panels. Like it's an appellate court on bonk to resolve who stole whose bike and other such heady matters before the Hot Bench. So that's my choice. And now you could also do something really seminal. I mean, you could do like an Oprah. Remember, you do not need to be an attorney to be a nominee or to serve on the Supreme Court. So you could go like an Oprah. You could really knock it out of the park.
Hot Bench. Okay.
Yeah. You're still captivated by Hot Bench. Yeah. Well, or you could have fun. I mean, if you really want like a Brett Kavanaugh contentious sort of confirmation hearing, although with the Susan Collins and the Lisa Murkowski's, how contentious could it really be? You could pick Sharon Eiffel from the NAACP Legal Defense Fund.
Okay.
Because that's like loud and proud identitarian claptrap.
Is Stacey Abrams an attorney?
She is an attorney. She doesn't need to be, but she's running for governor of Georgia.
Oh, well, maybe she won't.
Yeah, maybe she's
maybe
not on
not.
The short list.
No, I know she's not on the
short list. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of ways to go with this, but it's just you can't miss the irony and the tone deafness of the new Marxists when, you know, we're 40 years, 45 years removed from the Bakke decision, in which the Supreme Court upheld affirmative action but prohibited racial quotas. I mean, that's a sort of a distinction without a difference as the court has been wrestling this. And then the two University of Michigan cases, the undergrad as well as the law school cases from 2003, I believe, Grutter and Gratz v. Bollinger, where Sandra Day O'Connor famously opined in dicta in her concurrence. Or did she write the majority opinion? I think she maybe was the majority opinion that she wrote, going from memory here. My memory's fading. Maybe in a couple of decades we can get rid of affirmative action, but it's not quite ripe yet. Well, we're a couple of decades removed from that, and we seem to be going in full reverse, at least as far as the new left and the new Marxists of the new left are concerned. So if that's the way that the left wants to play it, then that's the way they're going to play it, and that seems to be the way they're going to go, doesn't it?
We have some text messages. What about Whoopi? She'd be great.
Whoopi Goldberg.
Goldberg, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And yes,
noted
Kamala.
Noted jurist.
Yes.
She presides over The View.
Thank you.
Adjudicates cases that are brought before The View.
Yes,
uh-huh. Uh-huh. Who else did you say?
They said yes to Kamala. Radical, but it'd sure be fun. Okay.
I don't think she'd get confirmed.
I don't think she would either.
Here's something fun, too, on the Kamala front, just in terms of the left's political promiscuity, really philosophical promiscuity. Larry Tribe, Harvard Law professor, leftist, writing in September of 2020, op-ed in the Boston Globe, about thinking about, of course, the forthcoming nomination that turned out to be Amy Coney Barrett. While the vice president has the power to cast a tie-breaking vote to pass a bill, the Constitution does not give him the power to break ties when it comes to the Senate's advice and consent role in approving presidential appointments to the Supreme Court. You don't have to take my word for it. Alexander Hamilton said the same thing way back in 1788. As two thoughtful Two thoughtful recent scholarly analysis have pointed out no vice president in our history has ever cast a tie-breaking vote to confirm an appointment to the Supreme Court. If Pence tried to cast the deciding vote, it would be the first time it's ever happened. That should matter to everyone. It certainly matters, or used to matter, to originalists who emphasize the importance of history. But there is much more to this than historical practice. Giving the vice president tie-breaking power over judicial appointments would also break the framers' careful constitutional structure. Oh, really, Larry? Well, I don't necessarily disagree with that opinion. I just wonder if it's still his opinion if you were to see a controversial nominee leveled up by Biden, and it could potentially come down to a 50-50 split in the Senate. There's arguments on both sides as in terms of whether, I mean, the Constitution is silent on the topic, so whether this is something that would exceed the power, the tie-breaking power of the vice president for a judicial appointment as tribe rights. But I just wonder, for all of those who were saying the same as Larry Tribe during the Trump years or cheerleading Larry Tribe's opining on the topic, is that still your position if it came to a 50-50 split in the Senate on whoever Biden nominates? Bill and Glen Ellen.
Yeah, I just want to say all those never-Trumpers who didn't like mean tweets, we now have a lefty who's going to be on the court for 30 years when we could have had at least a barely moderate conservative on the court instead. And finally, one last thing. How about a TikTok competition for the Supreme Court appointee? Maybe they can do that.
All right. Thanks, Bill.
Don't give him the idea.
Ron in Salem, Wisconsin.
Hey, good morning, guys. I don't know if you remember Rachel Dolezal. She was the white woman that claimed to be black. Yeah. You should nominate her.
Thanks for the call, Ron. Not bad. Rachel Dolezal from Washington State. She was an NAACP chapter president.
Right.
And it turned out she was a white chick. Yeah, yeah. We'll continue to kick it around. Maybe we can come up with some potential nominees that the president hasn't considered. Again, the only qualification, the only one that he's laid out, black woman, the former head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, former chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Joe Biden, a lawyer himself, a distinguished constitutional law professor.
Right, because he went once a year.
To hear him tell it.
Yeah. For 20 years, he was a constitutional law professor.
If only Joe Biden could appoint himself, well, here you go, in this identitarian era.
But he can't because he's not a black woman.
He can identify as one.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
So, you know, again, don't be so limited in your thinking. Black woman, somebody who identifies as a black woman. Does that qualify? It does, according to the left. If you say you are, you are. So that may open it up to a more diverse group of candidates than originally conceived. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer. On AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories. Only the biggest guests. And only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the fighting over the continued mask mandates at the K through 12 level, public schools, government schools, as well as private schools. More and more natives are getting restless on behalf of their kids.
Mm-hmm.
But so that means that some of these fights between parents and school board members and administrators and the teachers' unions are ratcheting up, and in other places and school districts are relaxing, and in other places they're doing what we've seen COVIDians do over the last two years at least, which is to double down, triple down, triple mask down.
Yeah.
So, for example, L.A. is now going to mandate non-cloth masks with nose wire.
So let me get this straight. For the past year, they've been using, you know, whatever, facial decorations. That's what Dr. Nguyen and Scott Gottlieb call them.
Mm-hmm.
And they felt safe that. But now that's not safe. And now you have to wear that painful N95 with the wire on the
This face. Just in, cloth masks do nothing. It only took us 2 years to realize what everybody understood, who was interested in understanding. from the beginning. So now we're going to move to non-cloth masks with nose wire. That's the requirement in L.A.
Yeah, they have them available at CPS, but they're not required at this point. And also not required, there was a talk, school board meeting, Chicago school board meeting yesterday. Now there is talk of vaccine mandates for all CPS kids because only a third of CPS kids are vaccinated.
And meanwhile, you have places like Atlanta, Fulton County in Georgia, going mask optional.
Mm-hmm.
And you have Loudoun County fighting the fight despite the Glenn Youngkin, because the Loudoun County board and administration is intransigent. They don't care what the governor has to say, so they're doing their own thing. And so the fight for sort of control of the future of the Loudoun County schools in the richest county in America, Loudoun County, Virginia, continues. We'll get to that, but first locally here.
Yeah.
St. John's Lutheran in Lombard, it's a small Lutheran school, about 300 kids. They recently moved to go mask optional effectively because, remember, nobody who doesn't want to wear a mask is trying to impose their will on others who do want to wear a mask. It only goes in one direction. Here's Dana Kozlov's report for CBS 2 Chicago.
Day two of widespread mask exemptions at St. John's Lutheran School in Lombard, and parents and a former staffer tell me at least 30 families filled out this form so the students wouldn't have to wear the masks. That's more than 10% of St. John's student population.
We need to keep our families strong, and we all think and feel how we do, and we're all entitled to that. But I'm not pushing any way or the other.
And I think it's really up to the, it's kind of left up to the family, to the parents.
It's the culmination of a two-month, often divisive debate within the small private school's community. Some families have left, and five staff members have even resigned in protest, telling me they felt their concerns were not respected. The latest, a fifth-grade teacher, sent this heartfelt note to families this week, citing factors including the events and decisions of the past several months as reasons she was leaving.
They did their best to support and stand as strong as they could, and they had to do what was best for them.
Given the state of affairs here at St. John's.
St. John's senior pastor even discussed the mask exemptions at church Sunday.
So we interfaced with our governing board multiple times, talked with our elders, talked with doctors, and sought outside legal counsel who advised us that this is a legally allowable right in the state of Illinois.
But spokespeople for both Governor J.B. Pritzker and the Illinois State Board of Education point out there is no religious exemption when it comes to the mask mandate. An attorney for St. John's points to the fact they are using the right of conscience law to allow these exemptions. The governor actually signed a law that would close that loophole when it comes to COVID prevention, but that doesn't go into effect until June 1st.
So it's, you know, not novel legal reasoning, but it's a fair interpretation of the statute in the Illinois Code as it existed before Jelly Belly signed that law that takes effect June 1, which we discussed extensively and so which right. We know about. And this is a situation, it seems to me, where the school is like, here's what we want to do, attorney. Now you tell us how we can do it, which is, by the way, how schools should be operated, rather than what should we do, attorney, and your school attorney gives you the path of least resistance, erring on the side of caution, erring on the side of compliance with state diktats because we don't want to fight. It seems to me the school went the other direction because of what the parents were saying, and good for them. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, 646-36, DA, turnkey.pro, text line. And of those staff members who left because they're, whatever, they weren't being heard or whatever their complaint was, they don't feel safe.
I can't teach from the grave, Dan.
Right.
Don't you know that?
Exactly. But, you know, so this is another move, finally, at least at this one little Lutheran school, that we're going to live based on most likely scenario. We are not going to step and fetch and do whatever the most afraid person suggests that we need to do in order for them to feel safe.
That's what they're doing in District 113, Deerfield Highland Park, you know, those absolute sickening COVIDians. On Tuesday night, they made up their own definition of what it means to be fully vaccinated. And now teachers have got to have the booster or they will be fired.
I saw the picture of this school in District 109 in Deerfield. These kids at lunch, these grade school kids at lunch, and they're sitting in chairs in a gymnasium, 6 feet apart. They're masked. They're eating lunch, and they're not allowed to talk to one another.
Yeah, there's been a no voice rule. I spoke with one of the parents. It's at Wilmot School. It's in an affluent neighborhood. No talking rule during lunch. And so they have to eat, pull down your mask, eat the food, and pull the mask up. And they cannot talk to anybody. If they do, they get a warning, and then they get sent to the principal's office. It is barbaric. We tweeted it out so you can see for yourself what is really going on inside schools. Because we talk about it, but to see it is completely different.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. Probably the visuals help, no question. My reaction to that, too, is thinking about how when I was growing up and we were learning about what school life, you know, we were doing a segment on the Cold War and what the culture was like in America. And so our parents would do these, you know, hide under your desk, Soviet nuclear strike drills. And, you know, we would ridicule, oh, my gosh, look at what mom and dad had to do then. How dumb were those adults in charge? Well, those kids hiding under their desk became their parents, became those adults that were mandating the hiding under your desk as some, you know, way to stay safe from a nuclear strike, for goodness sakes. So they became their parents, and then Gen Xers became their parents, and each succeeding generation is reaching new heights of foolishness. We're learning nothing. This is the power of the safetyist culture that didn't just arrive with the COVID outbreak. It's been a progression, just like the cultural Marxist progression through American institutions for 100 years. And it gets, and despite what you experience and what you remember laughing about, who's laughing now? More and more foolish because we're further and further down this road to safetyism over freedom.
And back to Loudoun County. I mean, he signed an executive order, the governor did.
We'll get to Loudoun County. Okay. John in Villa Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning. So we got two children going there because we decided we moved to District 45 Villa Park because we knew the schools were good. And because of everything going on, my wife's totally on board. Obviously, public school is no longer an option. So we started going to St. John's in January of 2020. They haven't stopped going to school like all the other flaky places. But they've had several meetings. And because I'm laid off in the winter, I did go to the last meeting that St. John's held. And Dan, you'd be proud. Because the board member, the board guy, not the principal, the pastor, and all the parents that were there, extremely well-informed legally and data-wise. It was such an encouraging meeting. And they talked about how they're going to go forward because there was another school up north that the media won't talk about that basically beat whatever Pritzker had legally. And they were like, well, we got the basis to go forward. We're going to do it. Now, it was three teachers and two aides or two assistants, whatever they call them, that have left, you know.
Hey, that's fine. You know, work wherever you want or don't. Just don't put it on me, you know. I mean, that's fine. But it really comes down to the conversation that is not happening enough, and I'm encouraged by what you've said about St. John's and what we're seeing from St. John's. What is the basis on which you're going to make these policy decisions? And yeah, you solicit input from everybody, as the pastor said he did, and I'm sure that happened. It sounds like it did. It sounds like you've got parents very engaged, which is not unusual in a private school. But what is the basis on what's the lens through which you're going to make these decisions? Whoever the most afraid is, whoever the loudest is, or whatever the most likely is, whatever the most reasonable is. And incredibly, it's been the former formulation, whoever's the loudest and most afraid, that has dominated the policymaking for the last 2 years.
Yep.
It's just incredible. Thanks, John. Appreciate it.
And the kids have to suffer in the meantime.
Ugh. Jim, St. Joe, Michigan.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. It's always great to listen to you. And Dan, you're right on with what you just said. It's the people that are in fear that are making these decisions. But what I've noticed, I'm retired, but I went back to work and I work in retail because I just don't want to sit home and listen unless I can listen to you two. I've noticed some of the employees that seem to come down with COVID are the ones that are wearing the mask. And a lot of us that refuse to wear it or don't wear it, we're all doing fine. And I wonder if they've done any studies on this. And the other thing that seems to upset me with these COVIDians and these leftists, well, leftists, they're not going to change, is they don't read and they don't research the science. They just, it's like you two say, they just follow the crowd. And I think it's really sad because they're teaching their children to just follow the crowd and live in fear. Thank you very much and have a good day.
Thanks, Jim.
I mean, the lefties love Northern Europe, and in Northern Europe, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Netherlands, they have never masked their youth in schools, on transit, or in stores.
Yeah,
never.
And the Danes, by the way, just declared COVID over, too.
Oh, that's right.
It's no longer, in Denmark, it's no longer like a socially, it's no longer whatever the terminology they used, a socially concerning virus.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, COVID's over in Denmark.
Yeah. In the UK, it's nice. Must be nice.
And here's the other thing, too, to follow the crowd point that our friend from Change Show Michigan was making. So very quietly, and we've been noticing this and remarking upon it the last few weeks, very quietly, you have some COVIDians mm-hmm. who are trying to cover their tracks. Don't pay that much attention. Don't look over there. They're pivoting very subtly to say, now is the time. We were right to do everything we did, but now is the time to move in a different direction. And an extensive piece in The Atlantic, owned by Steve Jobs's widow, left. The case against masks at school. This extensive piece. District should rethink imposing on millions of children an intervention that provides little discernible benefit. So to the question, has this been looked at? Oh, it's been looked at quite a bit. It's been looked at since the outset of the mask suggestion. And then, of course, what quickly followed was the mask mandates. The case against masks at schools, district should rethink imposing on millions of children an intervention that provides little discernible benefit in The Atlantic. Okay. Chris and Carrie.
Hey, good morning, guys. As you may or may not remember, my wife is a first grade teacher. She recently, on the playground, now this kid insists on wearing a mask on the playground. He bumped his head on one of the jungle gyms and was sobbing uncontrollably. He couldn't catch his breath. My wife is kneeling beside him and honey, please, pull down your mask. You know, take off this. And she was, like, physically trying to pull down his mask because he couldn't breathe. And he was so scared. He kept pulling that mask up.
I know.
And so it was an overriding fear to pull up that mask despite the fact that he was in pain and crying and hurt. And it doesn't help if the school announces, you know, three times a day, keep those masks up, you know, pull those masks up. And my wife just wants to scream. She is so tired of it, but she's handcuffed. She can't do anything.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah, and why are we masking children outside? I drive by St. Andrews on Addison there every day, and for 2 years they've had school, but they're masked outside for recess, and that makes no sense. Even Governor Pritzker said you do not have to mask up outdoors, and everyone's just so afraid.
Yeah,
I thought the Catholics were going to take the lead, you know? Come on, Catholics.
Sorry, we're not up to the challenge.
I see.
Thanks for the Lutherans in Lombard.
Yes, I love Lutherans.
Pete in Milwaukee.
Good morning. Say, these schools and teachers that are forcing these kids to wear masks and no talking during lunch, The teachers should be monitored. If you walk into the classroom and they are not wearing a mask, or you go into the teacher's lounge and they're sitting around without masks, they should be brought up in front of the school board or their boss if they even have one. If the kids have to, that means they believe, then they should have to wear them also.
Thanks, Pete. Frank, Arlington Heights.
Yeah, I wasn't forcing the mask to stay up. Sounds like the evil grandmother from Flowers in the Attic. Remember that movie?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But seriously, though, you had a good progression of the generations and so forth, how horrible, just, you know, how they're getting, how weak they're getting. And, you know, before long, we're going to have a generation that's like the Eloy from the Time Machine.
H.G. Wells, yeah.
Hey,
yeah.
Frank, do you allow your kids to take mask breaks during class?
They have to stay on the whole time. That's the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah,
are they happy about it?
If one of your kids pulls their mask below their nose, do you staple it to his face?
No. Okay, I've never stapled anybody's face. But one more point, Dan. Mm-hmm. Is this country going to get so divided that we're going to need a Diocletian to divide it? You know, Diocletian from the Roman Empire, 284 AD, split the Roman Empire.
I think you're waiting all morning to say this to Dan.
Well, first of all, we glossed over the Eloy reference, which I don't want to gloss over because for those who haven't read H.G. Wells in general or The Time Machine specifically, what's your point there?
Well, I mean, it's like with the Eloy. I mean, if you remember, I remember the movie especially too, you know, the time traveler comes back and, you know, those people, the Eloy, the people who are on the earth 400,000 years in the future, they don't read any books.
Yeah.
The books just become complete dust. They have no knowledge. They are just completely, you know, they're automatons or drones, whatever you want to call them. I mean, they're just, there's no civilization.
Exactly. There's sort of like the Illinois General Assembly. That's what I think of when I think of the Eloys. Thanks for the call, Frank. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So two arrests have been made in connection to the murder of that little 8-year-old girl, Melissa Ortega, in Little Village, shot in the head while she was walking with her mom. And the 16-year-old has been arrested as the shooter, 27-year-old as the
getaway
accomplice.
Driver.
Yeah. And of course, this now is the occasion for the performative emoting from the Chicago mayor and the Cook County State's attorney, just as we have seen this before from previous mayors and from previous Cook County State's attorneys. So this was the opportunity for Triple Threat and Kim Fox to make public their care and concern for their constituents.
Yeah, it's one press conference. My God, I wish I could have attended because I would have asked things so differently. But it started out with the pastor reading a letter from the mom about her daughter.
Moments before the incident happened, Melissa asked me, "Mom, can you buy me a hamburger?" To which I replied, "Of course." I wasn't able to fulfill that promise.
And she's holding her daughter's hand. She's like, "Promise you'll buy it for me?" She said, "Yeah." And then she said, "The next thing I knew, I was still holding my daughter's hand, and without explanation, I found her on the floor in a puddle of blood and a bullet to her head."
And Triple Threat and Kim Fox say what to this? And the occasion of arrests in a murder case in Chicago, which, you know, is the exception, not the norm.
Well, Mayor Lightfoot, she was openly crying and wiping her eyes while this pastor was reading the letter. Mm-hmm. From my source that was in the room, they said everybody, there was not a dry eye.
As a mother myself, it's hard for me to imagine the pain that Araceli feels that will haunt her, no doubt, for the rest of her days.
And we've seen the mayor cry before, you know, especially when children get shot. And then Kim Fox had to pipe in, and my God, I would love to get my chops on her.
The murder of 8-year-old Melissa Ortega is horrific.
Oh, yeah.
Melissa is an American dream that has seamlessly and senselessly been taken from all of us while merely walking down the street on a Saturday afternoon with her mother. Mm-hmm. To Melissa's mom and her family, I have no words that are of comfort to you, but I'm committed to getting you justice.
Mm-hmm.
Melissa's mom, Araceli, said that she forgives the shooter because the city failed that 16-year-old, too.
Yeah, she wrote, "You were a victim, too. As a 16-year-old, the community failed you just like it failed my precious baby."
Is she right?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Is this the village's fault?
They took away so much from her. But is it the village's fault?
Yeah, is this the village's fault? I mean, I appreciate, particularly in these moments, her ability to forgive. She must be a wonderful Christian lady, but that doesn't make sort of a cliche like the city failed you. You're a victim too. That I can't let that go without comment. Is that correct?
Well, I can't let this go because my police source told me the 16-year-old was out on bond for, guess what he was doing, Dan? He was out on bond for a prior carjacking. Mm-hmm. And we're going to find out more information. They're both going to be in court today at 11 a.m. They didn't release the 16-year-old victim. Even though they're charging him as an adult, they didn't release his name. And the only reason why I want his name and others want his name is to find out his priors. We're not going to say his name on the air or that scumbag 27-year-old who recruited him to be in a gang. But that is what my source told me, that he was out on bond for carjacking.
So if that's true,
That's Kim Fox's fault.
Yeah. No. He's a victim. The village failed him. Number four, maybe that'll be number five once we get the full background on his record, if he indeed does have one,
and
the
16-year-old,
the shooter, yeah, as well as the 27-year-old accomplice.
I'm not saying his name.
CWB Chicago, keeping track. It's New Year. Restart the count. What was it last year? 5 dozen individuals out on electronic monitoring for a felony and committed a murder or an attempted murder while they were on electronic monitoring.
Yeah, and we have 2,300, this according to the mayor's office, still 2,300 out on electronic monitoring who have rapists charged with, 92 of them have been charged with first degree murder.
And
not one reporter in that room asked, you know, don't you think you're to blame for this, Kim Fox? Not one stupid.
So we're restarting the count in 2022. We're already on to number four, and we're not through January yet. CWB Chicago, 7-time felon on electronic monitoring for his 4th gun case, tried to shoot and kill his girlfriend's father, prosecutors say. A 7-time convicted felon who was on electronic monitoring for a Class X felony gun case. We need to get guns off the streets.
Oh, right.
Was charged Wednesday with trying to shoot and kill his girlfriend's father in an alley behind their home. He is the 4th person charged with shooting or killing or trying to shoot or kill someone in Chicago this year while awaiting trial for a felony. Is that the village's fault, too, this case? Is this 7-time convicted felon, is he also a victim?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Bob in Buffalo Grove. Hey, Bob.
Bob.
Dan, question. You just mentioned a 16-year-old. I had heard it was an underage, but I didn't realize it was 16. Question. Where were the parents? Who were the parents, or where were they? How did he get the gun? I would assume it was a boy.
He was supposed to, Brown said he was shooting at 3 other gangbangers that were standing on that corner.
And he shot at him from an alley.
He hit one of them, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But then he hit Melissa, too. It's a war zone. People don't even leave their houses in Little Village.
You know, when we talk about school shootings, when we have the unhappy occasion to have to deal with a school shooting, the question, thanks for the call, Bob, the question that Bob raises always comes up immediately. What did the parents know and where were the parents? Why doesn't it come up in these cases? Why isn't that question asked in these cases?
That's a good question, Dan.
Huh, I wonder. Elliot on the south side.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Thank you for taking my call. Regarding the 16-year-old who was the shooter in the case, there's a reason why the driver was the adult and the 16-year-old was the shooter. These kids get slapped on the wrist and sent home. The name we should remember here is Emilio Copino, because that is the name of the shooter. His three previous convictions were all carjackings. He's allowed to go back on the street. Even if he gets convicted for murder, he'll be out by the time he's 21 years old. And then he'll probably do it again.
How did you get his name? How do you know his name?
Well, how do you know his record?
I'm not going to say my source, but I know that for a fact.
Yeah, that's what my source told
me.
Okay.
Three previous carjackings at 16. Is he a, thanks for the call, Elliot.
Probably doesn't even have his driver's license.
Is he a victim? I mean, he's obviously a member of a gang because he was shooting at members of a rival gang, according to police reports.
Yeah, and Superintendent Brown said that yesterday, too. He was a gang member, but not saying the gang's names.
So, I mean, I still would like somebody to answer that question. I mean, and this is no disrespect to Melissa Ortega's mom, but you have to address that characterization. I don't think you can let that go unanswered. He's a victim too. The city failed him.
The community failed him,
Joe in Naperville.
Yeah, well, you know, if the city failed him, then maybe the mom should sue the city for multi-$1 billion. When is the federal government going to come in and go after these games with RICO stature? You mean this 16-year-old kid did this all by himself? He didn't have a capo that gave him orders to do this? Where's the feds to stand up and go after all these gang members under the RICO stature? I don't get this, Dan.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call, Joe. I mean, we've seen that before with, you know, the famous prosecution of the El Rukins and Jeff Ford under RICO. But before we outsource all of our public safety to the feds and the attempt to eradicate or more realistically quell some of the gang violence, what about the people in charge here? I mean, if you're just saying we have to concede that the people in charge here are not going to do anything, okay, but that needs to be made explicit. There needs to be a public acknowledgement that we understand that our Cook County State's attorney, who we reelected, and our mayor are not interested in any of this. They're interested in crocodile tear photo ops. They're interested in identitarian politics. They're interested in sentimental invocations of identitarianism. The kids, the black and brown kids, they're not interested in public safety. Oh, if that's the truth, which it is, then fine, but I want it acknowledged. And then we can talk about what we can do in the interim before there's a chance to make a choice again about providing safety where those we put in positions of public safety provision have abdicated. But I want an acknowledgement. I don't want to just walk past them and say, here's what we can do. And we argue about federal prosecutors and the National Guard and all the rest of it. And I also want somebody to help me understand why the question of parents isn't asked in these cases. The Village failed. Mike in the Loop.
Dan, to your point, I cannot, for the life of me, figure out why these politicians are letting the city burn. I don't know what the upside is. Question for Amy. Why, during that press conference yesterday, why aren't the reporters asking those questions to Kim Fox? Are they afraid of her? Are they afraid of losing a source? Or are they just lazy? What's the reason?
I think they had, because the more seasoned reporters were on the Arne Duncan story, that he spoke in front of the Chicago Chamber of Commerce, so that knocked them out. And so you had these other reporters there that they didn't. How could you not ask him? That is such low-hanging fruit question. Was the 16-year-old on electronic monitoring? Either. Was the 16-year-old out on bond for a previous crime? If he's being charged as an adult, why don't we know his name? And then you have to have your police sources text you and call you and tell you what's really going on, because they're sick of this crap, too. And they're sick of Kim Fox, and they're sick of Superintendent Brown.
Yeah. You know, maybe, thanks for the call, Mike. Sorry, didn't mean to cut you off. But maybe if we provided Krispy Kremes for Ben Bradley at the press conferences, we wouldn't have to have these enterprising reporters that do such wonderful investigative work that hold those in power to account, because they're not fellow travelers, because they're not the comm shop of these politicians, because the editorial boards of the AFL/NPR, AFL-CIO / NPR Times, and the Chicago Tribune, and these network affiliate reporters, they're not in the tank for these politicians, past and present. No, that couldn't be it. Brian in Oak Forest.
Formerly Oak Forest.
Yes, I know. I wanted to give you the opportunity to say it, because I know it brings joy to you to say that.
It brings me a lot of joy. But my point is, has Black Lives Matter been on the scene since Saturday to set up a prayer vigil for this little girl?
No.
I'll wait.
Thanks for the call, Brian. Maybe Aurora Mayor Richard Irvin could call his friends at Black Lives Matter, organize a vigil, pass out some T-shirts. Maybe he could call his friend Father Flager, who's such an inspiration to him. Oh, you think Republicans in the state are going to hold this triumvirate, Jelly Belly, Triple Threat, and Fox to account?
Did you hear what Father Flager's working up?
Not the Republicans that the Republican establishment has chosen.
Yeah. I wonder if Irvin supports Flager when, gets out of jail for killing Laquan McDonald? Jason Van Dyke. They're going to shut down the CTA for 16 days, one day for every shot fired. Mm-hmm. And guess who takes the CTA? Hardworking Chicagoans and all CPS kids that need to go to school. And that's what Father Flager's backing, along with Rainbow Push. And Irvin, I wonder if he's going to support that. Mm-hmm. Shut down the city for 16 days. What nonsense.
Mike and Hammond.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Be careful with the calling this kid a victim. The one that shot that 8-year-old, before you know it, his attorneys are going to start suing the city for damages because they let him on the streets. They left him on the streets. That's all. Thank you.
All right, Mike. Keith in Kankakee.
I wonder if his mom will be in court today. Or dad.
Yeah, good morning. With the mother's comments about him being a victim, I wish you would have finished so we could find out who the oppressor is, right? Maybe she thinks CPS is the oppressor.
Mm-hmm. Well, she wrote, although I do hope that in the many years you spend in prison, you get time to reflect on your actions because you took away the most valuable thing I had in my life, my Princess Melissa.
Yeah, but that's not the question Keith asked. Is if he's a victim, then who victimized him?
Right.
The sort of this amorphous concept of the village? Do you want to get more specific? And I'm not here to probe mom in her period of grieving. This isn't a question to her. This is a question to us. It's a question to the city. Mike in Union.
Hey, good morning. You know, the politicians and their cohorts in the media think that they're all infallible. They can't do any wrong. It's the old Bill Clinton trick when they get caught doing something or one of their policies have failed. That it's always we, the people, need to do something differently, even though we all know it's all them. There will be no accountability. That's why this is going on. Have a great day.
Thanks, Mike. Yep. Triple Threat and Fox, Jelly Belly, I'm sure will weigh in at some point. They're just as sad and upset as you and me are, because, you know, they're just like us.
Oh, yeah.
By the way, there's a really good piece. I don't get to say this very often, so it's why I wanted to say this, by a Northwestern law professor in City Journal about those three and about how, you know, those three actually, not the village, except to the extent that the village elected them, are responsible for what has befallen Chicagoland. That's worth checking out. John McGinnis is the professor. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. On Tuesday, Secretary of State Tony Blinken said a couple of things. One, he said there's no daily between the United States and its NATO allies on the matter of Putin's revanchism. There isn't? Would Germany agree with that statement? He also said, while they're not going to make the document publicly because behind closed doors diplomacy has the best chance to avert an incursion, they did send some sort of confidential proposal to Putin that he takes, that he, they hope he takes seriously. What could that possibly be? What would they propose that Putin would take seriously from this administration? To help us with that, we're pleased to be joined by Dana Lewis, award-winning international journalist who served as a Moscow-based correspondent for 12 years at NBC and Fox News, and currently hosts the Backstory podcast. Dana, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, Dan and Amy. Good morning.
Good morning. So the confidential proposal, any intuition on that?
Well, I don't think you have to be a magician to know what's in there. First of all, very clearly, the U.S. is saying, and NATO collectively are saying, you will not tell us, Russia, who we allow to be members in the, you know, what appears to be the ever-expanding NATO. And then there's a lot of talk in there about de-escalation. If Putin is really concerned about European security arrangements, then let's talk about, you know, short-range intermediate nuclear missiles in Europe. The INF was abandoned by the Trump administration after Russia apparently violated it. Maybe more discussions on this, the START treaties, the strategic treaties on nuclear arms, and then maybe some discussions about troop movements, whether they be in the Baltics by NATO allies or whether they be Russian forces that are now moving very threateningly on the Ukraine border and then into places like Belarus. So I think there's, you know, there's a whole array of de-escalation. And look, one of the things I know you kind of said it with a bit of sarcasm there at keeping the offer from America secret. But one of the things by doing that, I think, is clever because it allows Putin to say that they won concessions and maybe gives him room to step down if he really wants to.
Well, what would the concessions be if what you said is what's contained in broad strokes in that confidential proposal? Why wouldn't Putin just file that in the circular file immediately?
Well, I think he will file it in the circular file because he's not serious about de-escalation. But if he would like to say that he won something, it's renewed talks on missile deployments in Europe. It's renewed talks on NATO deployments and rotating battle group movements, which you have from NATO through the Baltics, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. So, I mean, he can say that he won something and he pulled NATO forces in a way back from Russia's border.
Well, what's Putin's end game here?
Great question.
Well, what do you think it is, though?
Well, I think he's playing to a domestic audience. I think he has a lot of trouble. He's got economic problems. He is not popular politically. He is looking for a new term yet again in 2024. He's laying the groundwork. And the best way that Putin reaps sometimes popularity is to talk about outside threats and that he's the great defender of Russia. At the same time, they are losing in Ukraine. They have beaten up the Ukrainians for 8 years. They have killed them. There are 14,000 people who have died there. Increasingly, by trying to strangle Ukraine economically and threaten them militarily, they have pushed Ukraine. They haven't pulled Ukraine towards the Kremlin. They have pushed Ukraine towards NATO. That is speeding up along with European integration in the economy. He is losing ground, and he is scared absolutely of democracy on his border.
Well, you seem to suggest that Putin is playing a weak hand here. That's not how it feels, number one. Number two, everything that we've seen from Putin over the last 30 years, and we understand of his sort of philosophy, and we've heard this from presidents as well, both parties, is that, I mean, he wants to restore some semblance of Mother Russia to the Soviet era, to the great Mother Russia that dominated Asia and Europe. And so this is all part of revanchism, Crimea, Ukraine, potentially the Baltics from there. I mean, isn't that what his mind's eye is? This is the time potentially to strike and do what he's always wanted to do, which is to extend Russian influence in the region?
I don't think it's the time to strike because, to a large degree, he will not be successful. He may be successful in pushing into some of those rebel areas. And, you know, this is not my imagination when I answer your questions. I just got off the phone with former Prime Minister Mikhail Kasyanov, who is the former prime minister who served under Putin from 2000 to 2004. He mm-hmm. thinks that Putin is playing a weak hand. He thinks that Putin is desperate internally and that he is pushing externally. And yes, no doubt, he does dream about imperialistic Russia. But, you know, fat chance.
Well, what about the prospect of not, you know, giving the green light to those 125,000 troops on the eastern border of Ukraine, but trying to, you know, foment a coup in Kyiv and install a puppet there?
That's what he's done for years. I mean, I spent my career covering the Orange Revolution and then the Maidan Revolution. He is the one that put Yanukovych, President Yanukovych, in power. Mm-hmm. And then when Yanukovych turned away, this is the Ukrainian president who fled to Russia after the Maidan Revolution. When Yanukovych turned away from his own people demanding integration in the European Union and down the road NATO membership, then there was a bloody coup, you know, in Maidan, and many Ukrainians died.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but I mean, why? I mean, are you just suggesting the Zelensky regime is strong enough to withstand any sort of similar attempt?
Well, I think that Ukrainians will withstand any attempt. I think that the current administration is pretty wobbly in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. And so. I mean, Putin, it doesn't seem to me, would want this situation as it currently is to be in stasis. He's got to make some sort of move. So I guess one thing is he could, as you say, that this confidential proposal, I could accept some terms of it. I could characterize it how I want and declare victory. But it seems to me that's not strong enough if you suggest he's as weak as he is domestically.
Well, I think he's trying to destabilize Ukraine constantly, and that's what he's done over the last 8 years. And I think that the U.S. I also talked to John Bolton yesterday, the former national security advisor, former American ambassador to the U.N. And John says that, unfortunately, Putin still has the initiative, that he doesn't feel that the Biden administration has been tough enough, and promising sanctions later on is not going to be enough. And he says the U.S. should be placing troops in Ukraine right now, U.S. troops, so that when, according to, you know, to quote John word for word, he says, when Russian commanders look through their binoculars, they see American flags there, and they will have to think twice about moving forward. No doubt, I think, that he will move forward. I think Putin will do something. I don't think he's going to look for an entire takeover of Ukraine, but he will do something in those rebel-held areas. And will he openly invade with Russian troops? That's going to bring sanctions and crushing sanctions. I don't know what he's going to do. He may just step up and say, we're going to start supplying arms to the rebels because America and Britain and the NATO allies have been doing the same. So we're going to try to balance out the situation.
Where do you think those 8,500 U.S. troops who are on standby right now, where are they going to be deployed to?
Not Ukraine. They would go to the Baltics. By the way, my sources tell me they would be the 82nd Airborne, because they're the rapid reaction force that's officially on standby in the U.S. for anything that happens in the world right now. But they would go into Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, Poland, and they would beef up what are rotating battle groups right now, by the way, because they are NATO forces, but they constantly rotate because under the Russia-America NATO agreement, friendship accord, as it, you know, some people refer to it as that, there are not supposed to be bases on Russia's border. So in fact, the U.S., while it has helped with NATO expansion, it has not placed bases on Russia's borders. That could change. I mean, Putin is pushing us into a whole new area here.
So if Putin is as weak domestically as you suggest, we were speaking with KT McFarland on yesterday's program, you know, former deputy NSA for Trump. And she said one of the things that America could do and should do is to move towards energy independent policies rather than strengthening Putin's hand by reducing energy independence at home and necessarily increasing energy dependence from OPEC countries and Russia. And, you know, and that's not a light switch. That may take some time in terms of Putin feeling the effects, but signaling that you were going to do that would perhaps be more of a hamper or more destabilizing for Putin if he is so weak than some of these personal sanctions that Biden has suggested.
Well, I mean, the Biden administration is also talking about guaranteeing Europe energy, and they are now talking to Saudi Arabia and others so that if Putin turns off the tap, you know, places like Germany will stand together. And, you know, Blinken said yesterday there's no daylight in between NATO allies. I take your point. I think there is daylight there and there are problems. But, you know, Bolton says enough with Nord Stream 2.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. Don't wait till Putin invades. Make a commitment now that you're not going to turn the tap on. You're not going to agree to gas imports from Russia because he is already in Moldova. He is already supporting rebel troops in Ukraine. He is already in Belarus, and he's got to pull back. And the only way to do that now is to have energy independence.
Is there any prospect that he could face some sort of internal coup within Putin ranks if this show of force on the Ukrainian border doesn't turn out well for him?
I don't think he can face a coup. I think he's still very strong. But my sources tell me Putin has become much more isolated in the last 2 years. He used to hold like 25, 30 meetings a day. He's sitting out at his dacha, largely holding video screen meetings, meeting with four or five people. You've seen a strengthening of the power ministries, the KGB, the former KGB, which is the FSB now, the army, the internal police. They are much more prominent in his inner circle. So, yeah, there are dangers from Putin because ultimately this is a kleptocracy with mm-hmm. billions of dollars stolen mm-hmm. in put in foreign bank accounts. If you take those sanctions on Russian banks, and I talked to a former U.S. Treasury official who used to do these sanctions after 2014. He said, if you actually take U.S. sanctions on Russian banks, the economy will be strangled. Those banks cannot operate. They cannot carry out transactions with U.S. currency. I mean, they are done. It's a death sentence. And if Putin takes that step and the economy, never mind just for average Russians, because I don't think he really cares about them, but his inner circle, those oligarchs, and 400 oligarchs would appear on that list of sanctions. If you take sanctions against those people, I mean, they can get angry and pretty quick, and they can turn on him. Now, would he do it? I don't think he's going to roll that dice.
He is Dana Lewis, award-winning international journalist who served as a Moscow-based correspondent for 12 years at NBC and Fox, currently host of the Backstory podcast. Dana, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good to talk to you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560 The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Back to Loudoun County, Virginia. Loudoun County, the wealthiest county in the country. Loudoun County, ground zero for the fight between parents and their superintendent and their school board and their administrators over COVIDian restrictions, over critical race theory and other curricula issues.
And over same-sex bathrooms, which ended up in two kids getting sexually assaulted by the same kid.
Well, the focus now with Glenn Youngkin in the governor's mansion there in Virginia and issuing the order to eliminate mask mandates at the K through 12 level with a half a dozen school districts resisting Glenn Youngkin, the fight continues in Loudoun County. You know, just because you win an election doesn't mean the other side relents, particularly when the other side is the new Marxist side. They never, ever relent. Never, ever relent. You know, just because Breyer's retirement is in the news. Have you seen recently the New Republic has launched a campaign to impeach Clarence Thomas? Impeach Clarence Thomas.
For what?
3 decades in. Never relent because the suggestion is that he failed to recuse himself from cases involving interests with which his wife is aligned, his wife Ginny is aligned, you know, conservative groups and so forth. I mean,
that's a crime.
Without getting too deep in the weeds, right, okay. I mean, there's no basis for it. There's no basis for it. There was no need for recusal in the cases that have been cited. But they're still smarting over Clarence Thomas's elevation to the Supreme Court, still hounding Clarence Thomas. You think they give up? You think losing
it's
a
some
governor's,
tenacity.
You think losing a governor's race in Virginia is going to dissuade these COVIDians from their appointed rounds? No. So here's what's going on in Loudoun County at present. And the good news is that the parents who, many of them Democrats, who led the revolt that ended Terry McAuliffe and installed Glenn Youngkin, they're not relenting either. Here's a mom that has two daughters in high school in the Loudoun County School District telling the audience what's happening.
Soaring 85-degree temperature, restricted access to water, limited lunch breaks, escorts to separate bathrooms, no in-person learning, and threatened removal from Bible study. No, this is not a scenario from the 1950s-era segregated school classroom. This all happened yesterday and today at Woodgrove High School and was personally experienced by our two daughters, who many other brave students joined, decided to exercise their choice to not wear a mask per Governor Youngkin's executive order number 2. Welcome to the new civil rights battle.
Welcome to the new civil rights battle.
Yep.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. There's more. Nick Sanchez is a high school student in the Loudoun County school system, and he recounted for a local news affiliate there, the local network affiliate, what happened to him when he refused to wear a mask.
New at 6 o'clock, we're hearing now from a high school student in Sterling who took this picture. Take a look at that. He says it is an empty auditorium, and he spent the day there alone because he wouldn't wear a mask.
Oh,
he told our Nick Minock that he was given no course instruction, only saw a teacher once, and learned absolutely nothing.
It was really just a tough day, and, you know, all the harassment, you know, staff not being able to give me the resources that they have to because I'm not in the classroom, that definitely weighed in on just pretty much it being just a very tough day to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Sanchez, who's...
This against the backdrop of the piece in The Atlantic that we mentioned earlier in the program, which is just
read.
Great.
Yeah.
The COVIDian establishment pivots, and you're supposed to just celebrate the pivot and pay no attention to their policy advocacy over the last 2 years because, again, COVIDians are our gods, and like God, they do things in their time, not our time. The Atlantic piece, the case against masks at school, districts should rethink imposing on millions of children an intervention that provides little discernible benefit. Don't tell Randy Weingarten and the teachers union that. Another mom that spoke at the Loudoun County School Board meeting, most recent, also pointed out, of course, the hypocrisy of the school board, which is, you know, like shooting fish in a barrel in places like Loudoun County.
Yes. Okay, here you all are. You're unmasked. You're not social distance. You guys are a bunch of freaking hypocrites. You don't even follow the mask mandates yourselves, yet you want to mask our children for 7+ hours a day? It's a joke, and you all are a joke. It's not about the science or safety. It's about control and your uneducated, brainwashed, uninformed political beliefs. Because if it was about science, safety, and mask efficacy, then you all wouldn't be worried about the kids not wearing a mask because the mask would keep you all safe yourselves. It's about you all imposing your agenda on our families and our children, and the tyranny must come to an end. You're making our kids suffer, and we are done asking permission for our kids to breathe oxygen God intended for them to breathe. Thank you.
And she held up this blown-up picture of the school board, like posing for a picture, all of them, you know, standing side by side, smiling for the camera, no mask, no nothing, in school. It was just perfect, as were her comments. And you heard the applause. There were a couple of dozen, at least, parents who spoke at that meeting. So the battle is joined there. They're digging in as well, which is hopefully an example that more school districts will follow.
Well, I'm just so confused because this morning CBS is reporting that half of the school districts in Virginia are defying the governor's executive order. How can they legally get away with that?
Well, I mean, you know, you can litigate the matter as we're doing, you know, the flip side of that in this state. Tom DeVore, the attorney from Bond County, who's representing some parents of students and school district employees in some 140-plus school districts. It's a case down in Sangamon County. That's where the state capital is, Springfield, Sangamon County. And the ruling on staying the COVID mandates on testing, on contact tracing, on mask wearing, that is supposed to happen perhaps before the week is out.
Yeah, they're supposed to render a decision on Friday.
Right, tomorrow.
And, yeah, so we'll attorney is calling us right now because he's representing 145 different school districts around the state.
And we have said attorney Tom DeVore on the line now. Tom, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Give us just refresh our recollection. We sort of characterize it, but the nature of the complaint that you filed on behalf of all these school district employees and parents of students. The argument that you're making before the Sangamon County judge.
Gotcha. The arguments aren't very complicated under the law. As for the educators, the teachers, let's call them, the argument is that under the Department of Public Health Act, you can't mandate that someone either test or vaccinate. So it includes testing as well, because they have a right to refuse under the law when you're trying to limit the spread of an infectious disease. And if they refuse, your only recourse is for the health department to potentially seek an isolation or quarantine order against them, not to punish them with their employment. Same going for the masking as a type of quarantine under the law. For children, it has to do with the masking and the exclusion policies from school. Under the law, masking and exclusion from school are covered under the Department of Public Health Act, and that it can't be done by anyone except for the local health department. And if the parents refuse on behalf of their kids, they have due process rights under the law. That's the arguments. That's the arguments we've made to over 10 courts prior to this entering into Sangamon County, and we won that every time, at least in the other circuit courts.
So what would this mean for the state of Illinois and the kids in this state, I should say, if the judge agrees with you?
Well, it depends on how the judge agrees with us and the timing of that. So we have asked her, there's 146 school districts in this case, and we have asked her to cover all of the children in each of those 146 school districts. So as we have raised the case, the broadest it could be if she assumes to cover all of the kids in what's called class certification would be the kids in these 146 school districts. But beyond that, I think it's still important for a statewide, because this ruling on this mass scale, should she grant the relief that my clients are asking, I hopefully tells a lot of these other school districts you know, about what the law really says versus what the governor's office has been feeding to them for a long time. And I think we're seeing that because school districts on their own volition, since this case has started, have started pushing back on the governor's requirement, saying that we don't believe that you can make us do that. So it's having an impact.
And just to be specific, this Department of Public Health Act, so, you know, the law here, something that we've forgotten about, where we just have public health officials and politicians making the law by fiat. The Department of Public Health Act, you mentioned it, cannot exclude students for public health concerns without their parents' consent or a quarantine order from a public health department. Obviously, these plaintiffs have not provided their consent. And what you're telling us is that in these school districts, there's been no local public health quarantine order. And so they've imposed something they don't have the power to impose under the law.
Absolutely. And again, that's what it is. And keeping in mind, even though the, you know, it doesn't get told across the state, that exact argument that you just gave, six judges in central to southern Illinois agreed with that argument and actually entered orders against school districts saying you must follow that written procedure. Now, you guys should understand this too. When we argued in court, the attorney for the teachers unions actually said to the judge, well, if we give these people individual due process rights that Mr. DeVore is saying they're entitled, well, the system will collapse. It will break down upon itself because we have to do this. And I started laughing, going, that's not a reason to disregard the law because you don't think it might work. I don't agree with her that the system would collapse, but I think what's important to take away from that is everything that they're doing, the governor, these agencies, are trying to work around people's due process rights because they think it's inconvenient.
Yeah, that's an amazing statement to say. We can't afford due process. We have to have martial law because it's just too inconvenient. So that's an interesting perspective on
Ms. Haggard made that statement in the court. It's in the record.
It's just remarkable. So what are you, I mean, obviously you're hopeful that the Sangamon County judge who's handling this case rules in your favor and grants the relief you're seeking, but she's also previously ruled against you when it came to Governor Pritzker's unending series of emergency orders. So how confident are you?
That's two different questions. Actually.
Well, I know it is, but still.
Yeah. Well, again, and they tried to push the judge. And again, I never try to speculate on what a judge will do. But when they tried to push her on her prior rulings in the court case, which I thought was improper, but nonetheless they tried, the judge was very adamant to say that was a long time ago. That was a year and a half ago, and things aren't the same now as they were then. So I don't, regardless of how she rules, I don't think she's looking at this particular issue through the same lens she was looking at it 4 months in to this. So if she would grant my clients the relief, what I would take from that is that while she may have been willing to give the governor a little bit of deference a year and a half ago to try to manage these things, he took that deference that the court gave him and completely abused it, and now here we find ourselves 2 years later with him going even further than anyone could have ever expected.
You know, I watched some of the trial.
And I need to make sure it's clear, too. The arguments that we're making today were not the same arguments that were made a year and a half ago. It's completely with a different legal, even though it was the same issue, masking in schools, we never went down this path that we went down now. So the arguments are different, but go ahead.
Well, I just didn't like, because I watched some of the case and or the court proceedings. She never asked you any questions.
I never got asked one question in 4 days.
I know. It was so annoying. I feel like she's siding with them already.
Well, the flip side is maybe the answers are so obvious.
Yeah, and I wouldn't infer what you inferred there. Because, again, you just never know. You can also infer from that, if she didn't ask me any questions, she wasn't, I mean, because I've been in courts a lot, I've been in appellate courts a lot, and many times if a judge is looking at your arguments with skepticism, they'll start picking holes at what you're arguing, right? And if they perfectly understand what you're arguing, they won't even ask you any questions because it's clear where you're at.
Right.
So she didn't ask me any questions, but again, if she would have been asking me questions in the same manner that she asked the school districts and the governor's attorney, you know, I would have said, okay, she has skepticism with our positions. But she was very skeptical in a lot of the questions that she asked school districts and the governor.
But the superintendents, they got up there and just made these random blanket statements like one of our students came home and gave COVID to grandma and killed her. That is so. That's just feelings, and there's no proof of that.
Well, let me humbly suggest to you that when the governor's attorneys argued 4 months into this last year in front of the judge, that's all they used. They used those same fear-mongering emotional arguments. And again, people are humans. Even courts are humans. So when you make those arguments in the times of a few months into something that everybody's scared about, it can have an impact. But almost 2 years in, I'm hopeful that our courts are looking more at the law than they are being scared. And I think you're seeing that across this nation. Courts are striking this stuff down everywhere because the legal analysis is what's controlling the day and not the fear narrative that was being pushed at the early onset and still being pushed 2 years in.
So you mentioned you've spent a lot of time in appellate courts. Well, that's where you'll be back if you're successful at the district court level, right? I mean, you expect that Kwame Warul, if you're granted the relief you seek on behalf of your clients, would appeal this to the appellate court. But the presumption would be that pending any sort of resolution of an appeal, that these mandates would be off if you get the ruling you're seeking.
That is absolutely what would happen absent a court issuing a stay, which, again, whether that would happen or not, I won't speculate. But I would expect, should she grant my clients relief, that those, you know, those TROs would be in effect. And that would stay that way until, again, the appellate court takes a look at this case.
He is Tom DeVore, attorney with the Silver Lake Law Firm, and representing, again, parents of students and school district employees in more than 140 school districts in this case. So we'll be watching, Tom. Best of luck in court.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Listen up, you racist crackers. Particularly in River Forest, but everywhere.
Yeah.
You should be a little bit more like River Forest.
Yeah.
River Forest Mayor Kathy Aducci, the former Mrs. Al Ronan.
Oh.
True.
So things weren't good at home?
Well, Al Ronan, whose lobbying firm was indicted as a criminal enterprise, somehow he escaped the clutches of justice because, you know, it's Illinois. She's the mayor there, and she recently kicked off a white accountability re-education series for honkies in River Forest.
I'm saying it's honkies.
Why? If George Jefferson could say it, why can't I say it?
I haven't heard that word since the 80s.
The Jeffersons?
Since the Jeffersons.
Yeah, well,
honkies,
if Sherman Hemsley
that?
Can get away with it, I can get away with
and
it.
And I love the way you said it. It was such a great show. I love that show.
That was a great show. Yeah. All right. So these yes. honkies in River Forest that are racist.
Yes.
They thinking they can live in Mayberry. Wrong.
Well, I've always heard River Forest is Mayberry. Growing up, I have friends that live there, too. They're like, oh, yeah, it's like Mayberry here. Oh. Should I tell them that they can't call it that anymore?
This re-education series for the River Forest honkies was hosted by Dominican University. Of course it was. And their DIE director,
oof.
Oh boy, you got to see this, babe.
I mean, that's, oof.
Precious Porous.
And she looks like, well, I'm so rude. Well, I'm not. Well, you can see it for yourself.
She looks like she swallowed former state representative Kathleen Willis, which those people out Elmwood Park River Forest Way will understand. That's a good reference by me.
That is very, okay, good job.
She looks like, actually, you know what? They should try to raise money for OPRF. For their segregated classrooms. I got an idea. Precious Porous, who is bigger than Precious from that movie.
That's
Precious.
What I was going to
yeah.
be rude and say that.
I think she and Jelly Belly should do like a charity sumo wrestling match to raise money for the kids. The kids of color, of course.
It's all about the children. Yes, of course. Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. It's all about equity, too.
They brought in Precious and... The DIE folks, Kathy Aducci, brought in a racial healing expert.
Uh-huh. Yes, there is such a thing exists, people.
Sure.
That is true, yes.
there are cultural appropriation consultants. There are racial healing experts. You know, Race Hustle is good business. This guy's name is Reggie Williams. He's a professor at the McCormick Theological Seminary, apparently. The title of his lecture for the Honkies in River Forest, Longing for Mayberry, How Cultural Ideals Serve as Weapons of Exclusion. Williams, the professor, argues that River Forest Honkies improperly glamorize Mayberry, that fictional, idyllic place where the police have no work, everyone knows one another, and differences do not include race.
Yeah, Mayberry, North Carolina. Remember, you know, the setting of the Andy Griffin Show.
Yeah, I think we get it. The residents of Mayberry don't need to pursue diversity or race training, and Mayberry has no black residents on the show. Uh-huh. He said, the ideals of Mayberry are Trojan horses for harmful practices that favor white landowning males akin to, I'm quoting him, akin to Nazi Germany and apartheid South Africa, which are ideal communities populated with the ideal persons. I had no idea that River Forest was in the business of trying to create a master race, but apparently it is. Big problem. It's funny because it's a overwhelmingly Democrat socialist community. Kathy Aducci's a Democrat socialist. These Democrat socialists, a real purge. They seem to be a real problem. They're real racists because these consultants and these re-education series are all happening in places dominated by Democrat socialists. What's the problem with these honky Democrat socialists? Bunch of racists.
Well, I mean, do you think people in River Forest know that their tax dollars want to pay for this?
Mm-hmm.
Wonder how much he charges to do
speculating on what the honkies in River Forest know and don't know. That's dangerous business. He goes on to say the work of man as universal human must be undone, referring to Da Vinci. It's no exaggeration to say the well-being of the planet is at stake in conversations like this. White supremacy, race-based slavery, the writing of the Declaration of Independence were ideas born in the same moment in the same Western spaces, ironically with the same intent. Uh-huh. Yeah. The seminar was moderated by Amy Omi.
Who's that?
Coordinator for Truth, Racial Healing, and Transformation Center at Dominican, which is run by Precious. Uh-huh. Omi said the re-education series, like telling honkies how racist they are in River Forest, is how we disrupt the ideas, the policies, and practices that maintain racial inequity within our community, and how we do so through a theological lens. Oh, this is very Christian stuff, isn't it? Dominican University. Cross that off the list for the kids.
312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Yeah. Would you go to, you know, to purge yourself of your racism, particularly if you're a Democrat socialist? As I said, they seem to be the problem, according to these identitarians. Go to one of these seminars for the honkies to, you know, kick their cultural ideals, which serve as weapons of exclusion, according to the good professor, Reggie Williams, there.
Yeah, he said white River Forest residents should reject European narrative.
Yeah. Yeah, where are the, I'd love to hear from one of the enlightened residents of River Forest about their mayor and Dominican University, Precious and Amy and the whole gang, and how much better River Forest is going to be as a community coming out of this. Right? Ibram Kendi, the godfather of the anti-racist hustle, he recently gave a talk at some church about Christianity, which is what the Dominican University is doing here. This is the bastardization and redefinition of Christianity. Why not? Of course it is. Of course Christianity will be redefined by these hustlers. Here's what he had to say. See if Mr. Kendi, the celebrated Ibram Kendi, Henry Rogers, real name, see if this squares with your understanding of Christianity.
Liberation theology. In other words, Jesus was a revolutionary. And the job of the Christian is to revolutionize society. That the job of the Christian is to liberate society from the powers on earth that are oppressing humanity. Everybody understand that? So that's liberation theology in a nutshell. Savior theology is a different type of theology. The job of the Christian is to go out and save these individuals who are behaviorally deficient. In other words, we're to bring them into the church, these individuals who are doing all of these evil, sinful things, and heal them and save them. And then once we've saved them, we've done our jobs. And to me, anti-racists fundamentally reject savior theology. That goes right in line with racist ideas and racist theology, in which they say, you know what, black people, other racial groups, the reason why they're struggling on earth is because of what they're behaviorally doing wrong. And it is my job as the pastor to sort of save these wayward black people or wayward poor people or wayward queer people. That type of theology breeds bigotry. And so to me, the type of theology of liberation theology breeds a common humanity against the structures of power that oppress us all.
Yeah, sure. Applause from the church-going set. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636 DA, turnkey.pro text line. Do Precious and Reggie Williams and Kathy Aducci and Ibram Kendi, do they have it right? Is that a proper understanding of Christianity and the difference between savior theology and liberation theology, obviously?
What?
Kendi, a liberation theologist.
Why are they trying to repurpose the reason for Jesus?
Well, I mean, yeah, Jesus was a revolutionary. There's no question about that. But did you catch what Kendi is trying to sell you there? Savior theology is racist because it judges people based on their behavior. But what he says is black people, queer people, so on and so forth. It's because his lens is the group based on identity. And Christianity's lens is the individual based on behavior. That's the binary, if you want to boil it down. In point of fact, and rather ironically, but it's all covered in flowery language about love and tolerance, which is a lie. What they're proposing is the antithetical to love and tolerance. What he is complaining about, he's proposing. What he's suggesting fosters bigotry is not savior theology. It's what he's promoting because it's based on identity, not behavior. By the way, the church doesn't heal, God heals. Just a point of order, too. The additional affront of this and the disgraceful response from those in attendance at this ridiculous
seminar
demagoguery on hand for this ridiculous demagoguery. He provides this commentary with the backdrop of an inscription of the Great Commission behind him. You know, the Great Commission, the resurrected Jesus, tells his disciples to spread the gospel to all nations. Well, what Ibram Kendi is doing, the huckster that he is, Henry Rogers, is spreading hate to all nations because it's by group. And by identity, we make discernments, not by conduct. That's his argument boiled down in the simplest terms. And you heard at the end, power. So this is, again, just a racial order and a new racial order. Not really qualitatively different than Jim Crow, where you were marginalized based on your identity. Black people were obviously marginalized based on their identity, subjugated based on their identity. Well, Ibram Kendi is proposing the same thing. It's just a different racial group that gets the power and a different racial group that should be subjected to those with it, should be subjugated by those with it. Mark in Plainfield, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I'm a graduate of Dominican class of 2000, and I hear this debate, and it makes me sick. And for all the people that preach this garbage, so let me tell you, I'm of Polish descent, and in 1776, when America was fighting for a revolution, Poland was being divvied up by Russia, Austria, and the German state of Prussia. Poland never had colonies. Poland never owned slaves. When my ancestors came here in 1910, if you want to hear the privilege we received, try up Sinclair's jungle. The reason we perceive to have privilege now is because my great-grandfather married my great-grandmother and worked hard to provide a better life for my grandfather, who did the same thing for his son, who did the same thing for me. So if you want equity in the black community, I suggest black men start marrying the mother of their children, because right now, 3 out of 4 black children are born out of wedlock, and that is why you do not have this so-called equity.
All right, Mark. Deborah, Arlington Heights.
Good morning. I can tell by one statement that that guy doesn't know what he's talking about as far as Christianity is concerned. He's saying pastors are drawing people into the church and saving them. The only person or not entity that can save them is Jesus Christ and God himself. So he doesn't really understand Christianity at all, because it's impossible for a human being to save somebody.
Deborah, thanks. Kevin, Austin, Texas. Hey, Kevin.
Oh, hi. Sorry. I'm curious. So people like my mother who went to Dominican Hispanic Rosary, he's in effect saying that all those alumna are racist. And I'd love to hear, and a lot of these women who were on the west side of Chicago eventually settled in Oak Park, Rear Force, and then continued on. I'd love to hear what they think of what their alma mater has turned into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, were they courageous enough to speak? I mean, yeah, I know enough people in Oak Park and River Forest, and I know enough people that roll their eyes at these, white re-education seminars that Kathy Aducci is promoting to River Forest residents. But will they say anything?
Well, an ancillary issue, that Oak Park health director, Teresa Chappelle, you know, that small woman, tiny woman who took sports away from Oak Park River Forest High School. She's the health director. Over the weekend, she was talking that people who give birth aren't mothers, but rather should be called birthing people.
Of course.
She had a Saturday tweet, and she argued, you know, about Illinois schools and businesses should remain closed, and said before she did this, she was working on, you know, mortality rates during birth, and that there are birthing people, not mothers.
Yeah, well, of course, she's folding into the lexicon. That's nothing new. She's a public health director.
I know, but men don't give birth, and she knows that. She's a mother of three.
She's the birthing person of three.
Oh,
Chuck and Delavan.
Chuck around Englewood. Mayberry is in your mind. I'm in Mayberry right now. Then I was in Venice yesterday. I was over at the Skillet. Oh, my God, if you want to pick up women, there's tons of them over there. But I'm down here with my girlfriend. Yeah. Yes. But, the first problem I'm having down here in Florida is trying to get my Czech liver light to shut off. That's ever since I got here. I'm so glad I'm out of the Midwest. But, it's like Mayberry down here. I wish I was back up there so I could attend that thing. But
yeah.
Oh, yeah, right. Well, I would love to see you at that event.
There'll be more speakers coming in. Precious has a whole lineup there, Chuck. So you connect with Precious and, you know, get the schedule so that you can attend. That would liven up the discussion, I'm sure.
Yeah, because I never felt privileged before, working in a steel mill for 20 years and then high-rise superintendent downtown. And I don't know. I don't know what it was, but I must have missed out on something.
Thanks, Chuck. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Matthew Janicek was a history teacher at Glenbard South High School in Glen Ellen for 22 years. Was, past tense, got forced out. Why? Well, we'll let him tell his story. And we should note that his separation agreement with Glenbard South includes a non-disparagement clause. So, of course, we will respect that and the limitations that that clause imposes on our conversation. Matthew Janicek, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
You guys are more than welcome.
So tell us the story. You were a celebrated history teacher at Glenbard South for 2 decades, and then you weren't.
Well, I was actually technically at North for 18 of those years, and the last few years at South, and much for the same issues. They made me have to leave North and move over to South, hoping things may get better. But ultimately, they continued to deteriorate. So, and so I decided that after that many years, I couldn't deal with that type of restraint anymore. Yeah.
Well, describe the restraint at North then South.
Well, there's a few conversations over the years. One that kind of highlights perception versus reality. I think we are often taught, maybe it's corporate America also, but definitely in the education world, that perception is reality. Reality isn't reality. So when we would be having conversations on how to better instruct students in whatever capacity, data is driving today's determination. So whatever the numbers say is what they say. And then it doesn't necessarily always matter what the product is or how we get to the numbers we get to. What's important is passing rates and the appearance of success. So, you know, and that image issue, you know, is really, it's trumping any good diagnosis of what is really at the center of some of the problems in public education.
So do they want you to bend the curve so that people would be passing your class?
Yeah, in a larger sense, many districts have gone through this issue where they eliminated 3 levels of courses. Like we often had honors or AP, regular level, and basic. And many years ago, Glenbard isn't the only. Many districts have gone to 2 tracks, AP or honors, and everybody else. And what that ends up doing is it forces parents that want their kids to be in a higher achieving section, perhaps, then they have to take honors or AP, even if they may not really be equipped for that. And then the trickle-down effect from that ends up being, if your pass rate or your grades as a teacher fall below a certain mark, then you're on the radar screen. And the diagnosis of why a student might not be succeeding, maybe not reading assignments or completing tasks or just digital, you know, distractions in class, none of that stuff really matters. And it's very difficult to hold students accountable because today we're allowing students with the revisiting of grading and the retaking of tests and homework doesn't count. These are all things that are happening in public education right now that the teacher is solely responsible for. The administration is accountable to the numbers. Teachers are accountable for producing the numbers. And it leads to a climate of fear, you know, for people.
So that's on the student performance side, and that's certainly an issue, and that doesn't come as much of a surprise to us here. But what about the subject matter? How did teaching history change, or how was change attempted to be imposed on you over your career, and when did that start?
I would say through my career, it really amped up, obviously, after the 2016 election. Cancel culture ramped up big time. The narrative that is a double standard right now. Generally speaking, I would say that conservative-leaning teachers, right, are quiet, and they feel that they have to be quiet. Bringing up a topic in today's U.S. history or government classes about First Amendment rights and censorship may run the risk of getting a teacher labeled a conspiracy theorist.
Wow.
So there, and if one person is upset, whether it's a parent or a student, if one person is upset, that's who sometimes gets listened to, and including complaining or filing, I guess, complaints anonymously. That is also a norm now. An anonymity can wreak havoc on somebody's life.
Oh, I'm familiar with that.
So is it informal? It's just you know you're always standing under the sword of Damocles. Or were you instructed on certain topics? You shall not teach this topic.
You are actually told, and I'm not the only teacher. Many teachers would be empathetic with this in history, to avoid teaching controversial subjects in class and to avoid connecting history to the present day. Those are some of the norms I think that are out there. And I hold up the textbook and I say to students or adults, anybody, everything in this textbook is controversy. Politics, religion, civil rights, wars, everything. It's all controversy. But we're not trusted that much anymore to engage in those discussions for fear of offending somebody with a microaggression.
Okay. Well, how would you teach slavery then?
How do you do it? Well, I used to do it in a way where I would show a clip, that one clip from Spielberg's Amistad. We would talk about that, discuss the international slave trade, and then the abolition movement that coincided with it. But if you sometimes also teach how did slave owners keep slaves enslaved, I know we always had them read a good article that says you couldn't teach slaves how to read. It was illegal. And that kept people ignorant. So when you open that dialogue, and if you step on anybody's toes in that dialogue, or anybody takes offense to a way you've posed a question, the way you've asked a question, any statement you make, you are really walking on eggshells as a history teacher. And if they have the perception that you may be a conservative at all in your public life, then you are going to be targeted.
What about the 1619 Project curriculum? Did that insinuate itself into your classroom in your in the last couple of years of your teaching career?
I noticed it creeping in a couple years back, and we were instructed on the major premise of CRT. And some of the folks that are pushing that particular system, and the biggest problem they had with me and other teachers is we got sat down and basically they asked, how can you? Oh, this is what it was. There is no way that one human being can empathize with another human being because you're of a different race. So that was an expected major premise that was meant to be accepted by the teachers, that because we were a certain race, white, there is no way that we could understand what it's like to be another race. Now, on the surface, I understand that's true. But digging deep down, why am I teaching history then if we can't teach people to learn from other people's experiences? So on the surface, it expects you to accept that as a truth. Follow?
Right. Then it's a little difficult to address issues like the founders who were not slave owners, Thomas Paine, Alexander Hamilton. It's a little difficult to explain the civil rights movement in the 60s, which included whites along with blacks because they shared a common understanding of humanity and human dignity. So the point is to separate, not and focus on identities that are different rather than a common humanity.
Oh, unity right now in the system is talked about, but it is never really practiced right now. It is a culture of division. And I know I'm not the only American or the only American teacher that feels it's happening macro all over our country, that the forces in power, whatever layer they're holding of power, are trying to divide the people, and they're being very successful at it, you know?
I understand you were asked by your students at Glenbard South in 2020 to sponsor the political debate club at the school.
Yeah.
I'm surprised there is such a thing.
It was one of those gifts from God, I guess, a beautiful thing. Because, yeah, it has been stressful for the last four or five years without question in my life. And then to have the students. And I would actually survey my students as well and ask, you know, are you guys feeling like I'm pushing anything? And wildly, the answer is no. But then when the students asked me point blank, and it was a freshman, they said, hey, can you run political debate club? Because you're one of the only teachers here that doesn't pick a side. You don't pick a side. And I thought that was the greatest endorsement. But even though that was a reality in my life, it never resonated with anybody that had decision-making power. It was like it never happened.
Well, but in part, my suggestion would be that it's because you're compelled to pick a side.
Yes, in large part by default. Yes, and it has softened a smidge. You know, that first year, 2 years ago, when I mentioned we had been exposed to the major premise of CRT, it has dissipated a little bit because there has been quite a bunch of pushback. Really, we've been activated in a way. Those of us that believe in genuine, true equality, right, have had to push back. In that application of equality. If you believe it, you have to actually stand up for it now.
Well, do you miss teaching history?
Well, Amy, I do, but in an interesting twist, the day after I decided to resign, another gift from God gave me one class to teach in a private school. So I still have that.
Oh.
And the other part that I really want to make Americans aware of and so they understand that public education needs to be revisited, you know, pretty quick here, is that I've been hired to teach in an international setting. And I have foreign students that are in third and fourth grade that speak fluent English from around the world. And they are paying top dollar for me to come in and teach those kids in the exact same way that I used to teach my high school kids. Mm. Socratic method, in-depth discussion, challenging questions, all of those things. And I've landed 8 of those classes, and I'm going to continue to add more. And every time I have one of those classes, the parents of the international students, they ask for more classes. I haven't had one yet where I haven't had a follow-up class. So that has been a saving grace.
And mm-hmm. when you were going through your turmoil there at Glenbard South, without disparaging anybody or naming names,
mm-hmm.
What was the interaction or commentary you got from administrators, that you got from parents of your students? What was that like?
Generally speaking, it was a company line that the school saw me as really a threat. I think that when you challenge status quo, that you're just perceived as an outsider or somebody that is bucking the system. And I know that I had developed that reputation with them, I suppose, and they didn't want to really dialogue. There wasn't a dialogue. It was a one-way street. The parents largely that I had were wonderful, wonderful. And I missed them. And I sent an email to them saying, I really apologize. I hate, you know, leaving the school and leaving your students, because the relationships I've built with students over the years are really lifelong. I just had a kid text me right now. He's like, hey, Mr. J, you're sounding great. And the parents are wonderful. But if you upset one parent, or if somebody takes anything you say out of context, that cancel culture is alive and active. So, but by and large, the experiences I had with all my students of all colors, of all religions, you know, we have a heavy Indian population. We have a heavy Muslim population in the Glenbards. I could find plenty of those kids to come and speak on my behalf as well. They're beautiful. And I do miss that element of it, because I love public education. It's the only great equalizer that we really have. You know, these elite that I get to teach now, whether they're in foreign countries or in the United States, they're getting high quality Socratic discussion and essay writing and all that good stuff. And I want that for, and most teachers want that for all the American kids that we teach. It's just that, you know, we're not driving it anymore. The teachers are not trusted one, and then we're not driving anything anymore. We are actually evaluated pretty rigorously on things that we don't have any control over anymore.
Mm-hmm. So. And the union, were you a member of the union, and what did they do, if anything, during this?
I was a member. Yes, sir. I was a member of the union for a lot of years. And I didn't have overt issues like I had after 2016, I noticed, obviously, that the teacher union was beginning to more and more and more. And it's just, it's embarrassing now that they totally toe the line of the Democratic Party on whatever policy they're putting in place. So last year I withdrew from the union, but that was also after I did tap the union for some help in this, and they gave me the legal end that I could go to, but they didn't want to push back for me on my behalf at all with any of these other issues. They didn't want to push back. So because I was passively supported, I decided that I needed to drop that union, and I joined a union that a fellow teacher had told me about, the American Association of Educators, and that is a generally just a more conservative-leaning teacher union on the national level. So I used that, and it helped a little bit. Yes, sir.
Well, Glenbart South's loss is that private school you're teaching at now is gain. Matthew Janicek, former Glenbart South history teacher. Matt, thanks for joining us and sharing your insights. Appreciate it.
Anytime. I appreciate it. Thank you guys for having me.
Oh, thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Before Mike Scott's newscast, we talked to former Glenbart South history teacher Matt Janicek about how and why he was forced out of teaching history after 22 years in the Glenbart high school system. And, you know, the enforced orthodoxy. It's not an uncommon story anymore, but it certainly, I think, drives it home to provide a real-world example of somebody who was a celebrated history teacher who enjoyed the support and the thanks of parents and students alike, but is gone nonetheless. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line, your comments and stories on the topic, perhaps of a similar nature in the school districts that in which you operated, which your kids went, or
currently
you're generally
go.
Familiar or currently go.
But absolutely. One thing he said that really stuck with and should stick with all, just if all it takes is just one parent or one student to complain, because they always take the side of the victim first. And I don't know when that happened, when that shifted, instead of listening to both sides of the story before you cut somebody off and destroy their career and their livelihood.
Well,
but it happens all the time.
Taking the side of the person who cries victim, not necessarily
exactly.
An actual victim.
Was it Hillary Clinton that started, who started that? I don't know when that shift happened.
I think some of the other interesting comments included, he's a history teacher, stay away from anything controversial. Well, then I'm not going to be teaching much about the history of human beings on this planet, because there's
that's controversial.
Nothing but controversy and clashing and differences of opinion and fights, righteous or not, to advance or retard the enlightenment of the human being and the civility and the freedom that human beings enjoy. So, yeah. Yeah, critical race theory, which is not taught. He talked about creeping in the last couple of years. Of course it was, because of course it is. Nick Freitas is a delegate in the House of Delegates in Virginia, and he took to the House floor to respond to the ad hominem attacks of the identitarians, right? If you disagree with me, you're afflicted by phobias, your a manifestation of all of the isms, and he's just not going to take it. It's nice to see some Republicans feeling emboldened to take these individuals on straight away. It's frankly instructive. It should be instructive for Republicans in this state, but I haven't seen any Republican candidates taking on for governor, for legislator, for that matter, legislative offices, taking on these fights the way that we saw Glenn Youngkin and Republicans in Virginia take them on. It will be to their political detriment if they don't. Nick Freitas.
I'm tired of it. My constituents are tired of it. Because when these claims are made, they're not just made against Governor Youngkin. They're not just made against us. They're made in part against the people that elected to send us here. And I don't know a single person in this chamber that I would define as racist or sexist or bigoted. We have very different ideas about how to get to particular end states where all Virginians can be happy, healthy, prosperous, and free. But just so I'm very clear, will I be nice this session? I would certainly like to be, but I'm not about to sit here and listen to that, Mr. Speaker, and then go home to my constituents and have them ask me, why didn't you stand up and defend us? So let's have a robust policy discussion. But if you're going to question the faith or the intentions of anybody that happens to disagree with you on policy, then you don't get to lecture us on compassion, tolerance, or an open debate. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
That's so hard.
Wow.
Is that so hard to say? Dawn in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Okay, thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate what the teacher had to say, but I totally disagree with him in regards that the public education system is the great equalizer. The data and achievement gap would absolutely substantiate the opposite. In my own experience, my twins were not placed in general education setting from kindergarten. They were outplaced to a self-contained classroom. And any parent out there, if that's what happened or that is what's proposed to happen in your situation, that's against the law. Because the law says to the max extent possible, your child, just because they have a disability, is to be educated in the same classroom as a general education or general education peers. So, and what ends up happening is, and we all know there's least restrictive environment law out there. The districts don't follow them. Why? Because it's cheaper for them to take all of the kids with a disability and put them in a classroom like cattle. And you know what? Here's the thing, too. These schools, these teachers, they know the kids who are at risk. It's in state assessment tests called the AIM-LEBS. They know who the kids are who are at risk. They don't do anything. And you want to know why? Because they don't put policy in place that's already in the books. It's called response to intervention. They know these kids are supposed to get interventions. By law, the districts have to have a response to intervention policy, but they don't do it. So, you know, I would like everybody to look up Dr. Sean Robinson. Dr. Sean Robinson, he's out of the University of Madison, grew up in Wilmette, did not even read until he went to college in Madison. He's interviewed by somebody from the University of Madison, and she's sitting there asking him, how in the world, as an African-American, did you grow up in Wilmette, never learn to read? And he explained to her that they just passed him along from grade to grade without being able to read. Is that equity? Was he, and he, his main focus that he always talks about is access. We have to give children access. And what happens in the real world versus what happens in their minds, in the school minds, it doesn't affect them, but it affects African-American children, it affects the poor, and it affects kids with disabilities. And we are out there to advocate because we are trying to advocate not only for our children, but children who come behind us. Because we don't want to see parents have to struggle and fight like we do. So thanks so much for taking my phone call. And I do appreciate that teacher coming out and saying what they said.
Thanks for the call, Don. I think, though, to be fair to Matt from Glenbard South, formerly, I think he was talking about, you know, the concept of public education. I don't think he was necessarily giving a ringing endorsement to what government school systems are today. I think he was talking about the idea that it's a great equalizer, that it should be, it could be, and it should be the great equalizer, not that it necessarily is. But your other points are well taken. Jim in Tampa, Florida.
Hey, guys. Amy, you deserve so much credit for being a coach. Coaching is one place in schools where we can still teach the things that we need, the individual merit that leads to group accomplishment. You don't pass the ball to a person of a certain color. You pass the ball to the open player.
Right.
And you don't triple team somebody and let another person come straight to the basket. That's not how it works. You guard everybody. You don't draw your strength as a team just because you put on a uniform. You draw it because each individual player is doing their job to make the team strong. And these are the underpinnings. These are the things that can happen in coaching. It does happen in coaching. Amy, I know you teach this stuff, and that's the one place in the school where we can still get the job done.
That's why you record assists. Been working together as a team.
Hey, Jim, I used to coach.
Oh, that's right. You coached.
I coached. But I was sort of like Bobby Knight, Cobra Kai. A lot of sweeping the legs and a lot of throwing chairs. And so I wasn't asked back.
You coached MLB, right?
Bobby Knight, yeah. One of the best ever.
I led the league in technical fouls. Thanks for the call, Jim. Appreciate it. But yeah.
You know. You never got a technical, did you? Or did you? I never got a technical.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
What did you say to the ref? Or were you yelling at one of your players? Because I don't like that either.
I was direct, I would say, with the players. Now, again, this is, they had a comment. We're talking about third grade girls. And, if they don't learn then.
That's right.
No, I coach like 6th, 7th, 8th grade boys basketball. Mm-hmm. That's what I've done.
An MLB league, right?
MLB?
Yeah, wasn't that your league?
What's MLB?
I don't know. There's so many different leagues out there for middle school.
I coach like at a Catholic grade school, for a Catholic grade school, and then like in a park district league.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Are you going to think about coming back?
I'm not like everybody gets a trophy kind of guy.
No,
so
me neither.
I don't know if I fit in anymore. Maybe I need to skip right to like...
the pros?
Well, no, that's even worse. No, no. That's worse than grade
school. College, Division III. I could see you D3.
Yeah, I could I like to coach like at a good high school program or a good collegiate program. That'd be fun. Yeah, but it interfered with my golf game, so the hell with
right.
it. Paul
takes a
in
lot
South,
of time.
Paul in Southwest Michigan.
Hey, good morning, guys. To Amy's point about discussion and debate, I think we've lost that with Twitter. And those type of platforms where you've got, 180 characters or 240 characters, and people just throw stuff out there. And then when you respond, they just say, meh, and block you. We don't have any more debate. We don't have any reasoned thinking. It's just do it and do it as you're told.
Well, right. So, actually, thanks for the call, Paul. I mean, that was an important point that Matt, the history teacher, mentioned, is that, they asked me to moderate the political debate club because they knew I didn't take sides. I just, you got to lay out your case, and I would ask fair questions to both sides and so forth. Right. That doesn't happen because, as I said to him, well, the hierarchy says, no, you have to take sides. And by the way, it's our side. There's one side. It's our side. You shall comply with the enforced orthodoxy. And that's the end of the discussion. The debate is now concluded. And we see that everywhere, which, yes, of course it's a problem. It's a huge problem. And now you're seeing, and by the way, this has been going on for a long time. Nothing controversial, nothing to discuss. I mean, you have school districts that have been banning Shakespeare for the last decade.
Well, that's right.
A Washington area school district just became the latest school district to pull To Kill a Mockingbird. You don't want anything that's controversial. You don't want to have kids have to think. You don't want them to have to understand the history to perhaps improve upon some of humanity's worst excesses and worst moments in history. It's just remarkable to me. You have, there's all this, China produced an alternate ending to Fight Club where the police win because, of course, they don't want anything that foments subversion. But, China. The BBC is doing the same thing. The BBC is going back quietly until it was discovered by an alert listener and editing previous BBC programming from bygone eras to change words that are now deemed insensitive, according to, you know, Microsoft Word or the Google search engine minders. I mean, it's not just one classroom. It's not just one teacher. It's not just one school. This is everywhere now, and it's been that way for a long time, and it just rolls on. And people like Matt Janicek at Glenbard South just get rolled over. Candace, Mount Pleasant.
Oh, hey, Candace. Hi, good morning, guys. Hey, I'm teaching part-time now, and what I find is, okay, I've got fourth graders, fifth graders. They're still counting on their fingers, which is shocking to me. And it, in Common Core, when I try to tutor them, I'm not used to Common Core. They don't even know how to add and subtract like we did, which is the easy way. So, it's, and then when you complain about to the principal that Common Core is not working, you get this, well, that's what the state pays us for. So that, and I said, that's fine. Why don't you teach them that for the test? But actually teach them how to add and subtract so they're not doing it on their fingers and toes. Because that is embarrassing. I go, the problem that you guys have is you keep teaching by ditto and you're not drilling. That's how you learn your numbers and stuff, is you drill, drill, drill. I never counted on my fingers, ever, like ever. And these kids are like, it's so sad. It really, it's upsetting. I understand why a lot of teachers are quitting. I really do.
Thanks for the call, Candace. You know, we need, I mean, I know there are like some private, good private school options and charter schools, and there's some innovation in K through 12 education. But I just keep coming back to the Rosenwald Booker T. Washington schools for black kids during segregation at the turn, the beginning quarter of the 20th century. We need like Julius Rosenwald and Booker T. Washington types of the 21st century to open more and more K through 12 systems, particularly as private schools fall prey to the same anti-intellectual orthodoxy of as the government schools. I just keep going back to that. We spent a lot of time on higher education, but higher education doesn't matter much if what's going on at K through 12 at the K through 12 level is anti-education. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.